My passion is the fight for freedom. My father fought for him in World War II defending our country. Today, we are no longer fighting with guns. Instead, we are fighting an ideological battle for control of our country by contributing to causes that support your constitutional rights. I am Patriot Mobile.
That was a shooting gallery up there.
I could hear the tremble in his voice.
She suffered a fairly severe beating, and the video is pretty graphic.
Justice for us seems almost impossible.
It's not fun to watch somebody die, and they knew she was in mortal peril.
They have not asked the hard questions. Why was the Capitol intentionally unsecure that day?
The FBI had information about security concerns before January 6th.
They're out for blood, and they're getting it. They appear to be winning.
Were the actions of the Capitol Police out of line? Were there violations in use of force?
Now I describe it as an inside job.
I'm ready to do whatever God calls me.
There's an old Chinese saying my ancestors learned before the Communist Party took over our country. The family is the essential unit of human society, and that you must have honor and defend your family. But it's not always easy to do.
When the regime gives the order, you have to kill.
My heart was pounding. I felt my body bouncing and twisting on the floor. They put numbers on our shoulders, then separated us into rows of even and odd numbers. I was number 9. My brother, he is still in prison. And my sister, she was sent to a labor camp without a trial. But there's one piece of evidence they haven't been able to destroy yet. I left everything behind. If I can't expose what they did to us, then all of our suffering would be for nothing.
Welcome to Chosen Generation with your host, Pastor Greg Young.
But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should shew forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy.
And now, Chosen Generation, where no topic is off limits and everything is filtered through biblical glasses. And now, here's your host, Pastor Greg.
And welcome back to Chosen Generation Radio, where no topic is off limits and everything filtered through biblical glasses. Thanks so much for being here. I know you have a choice of where you can listen and watch us each and every day. And I thank you for keeping it tuned here to Chosen Generation Radio. Well, I'm really excited to watch this. I have some good friends, Dr. Brian Hooker being one of those, that is a part of the Children's Health Defense. And Children's Health Defense was founded by the gentleman that my next guest has written a book about, the real RFK Jr., and I'm very pleased to welcome Dick Russell to the program. Dick, welcome. Good to have you with me. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Pastor Greg. Good to be with you.
Man, oh man, what an incredible family history that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. comes from. However you view it, however you might look at it, to see what Joe Kennedy did and accomplished, to see the tragedies that were a part of the Kennedy family history, and then how that impacts someone like RFK Jr., it has to be just pretty amazing.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, of course, he was raised in this amazing milieu when he was a kid. His uncle was president of the United States, and then his father was running for president in 1968. Of course, when he was assassinated, and the result of that was years of anguish for the whole family, but for Bobby, as he was called. I mean, it was really a devastating, and he went through some very tough stuff for a long time. He was even an addict for some years, and eventually went into rehab and became part of AA, which he's still part of today and has helped hundreds of people. He's been sober now for 40 years, actually, since 1983, and in the course of that, he's just helped many, many people like himself, and I think it puts him in a unique position to address the opioid crisis that we're in now, with so many kids dying of fentanyl poisoning, and he's been there. He knows what he's talking about. He can help.
Now, how long have you known Robert Kennedy Jr.?
I've known him for more than 20 years. We started out working kind of on the same page in environmental issues, a fight to save the gray whales from an industrial salt works in Mexico, and then the Atlantic striped bass. I'd been very involved in a campaign to protect that fish, and he was also involved in similar efforts in the Hudson River with stopping the pollution there and enabling the fisheries and the commercial fishermen to come back. So we started out there, and over time we just became close friends, and the biography is not co-written with him, or I guess you could say it's authorized, because he certainly cooperated with me through the whole thing. And we sat down for many interviews, and I interviewed lots of people about him in an attempt to really set the record straight about who he is, because he's had such an incredible both life and career as an environmental attorney. And he was just getting, maligned in the media, just attacked for his views on public health, which they felt were, a lot of the big media felt were not towing the party line, so to speak. So
is that specifically relative to the issues between big pharma and natural medicine, naturopathic type of medicine? Is that what we're kind of referencing?
Well, it's, yeah, in part. I mean, certainly we're really referencing the fact that he did not believe that the vaccines are adequately safety tested.
Okay.
And that that's what he was calling for. He's not anti-vax in the sense he's just blanketly opposed to any vaccination, but he feels like, and he's right, I think, that these were not tested against a placebo, for one, and then they were just sort of, both in the childhood vaccine schedule and then later with COVID, the vaccines were rushed to market, and he didn't feel that was the way it should be done, and especially when there were alternatives that were, again, poo-pooed by the big media, but like ivermectin and even hydrochloroquine that could prove effective in preventing COVID.
Well, I think even more to the point, the fact that remdesivir was being proven to be deadly,
exactly,
and the clinical studies had already shown them that it was potentially very deadly, causing further respiratory issues rather than rescuing people. They were sentencing people to death.
Exactly. Yeah, and from my understanding, it's basically a financial deal, between the manufacturer.
Oh, yeah, tons,
Remdesivir. And I mean, the fact is the pharmaceutical industry has grown more and more powerful over the last, 30 years or so. I mean, they were never used to be allowed to advertise on TV. There's only one other country that allows that, and it's New Zealand. But here, you know, it dominates the coffers of the evening news, and yep. So they're not going to come up against different pharmaceutical companies. Well, that are
one of the famous things, Dick, right, is the little voice that comes on and says causes and death. Oh, okay, let's take that because, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Cause exactly. You, it's going to cause you to grow a third eye, but, you know, come on. Everybody could use a third eye.
Well, we could, actually.
It's really quite ridiculous. All right. So talk to me. You said that he's, you know, been maligned in the media. Talk to me about some of the things that that you identify in the book that are, I don't know, maybe things that people are led to believe. He seems to me, let me just say this, I come from a biblical worldview and I guess you could say conservative. I prefer to just say that I come from a biblical worldview. Mm-hmm. That being said, I find him to be somewhat of an anomaly a little bit because he certainly brushes on a lot of those things. Which tends to lead me to believe that he has some strong connections to maybe the Catholic upbringing or the Catholic background or what have you that he came up in, while having some very libertarian ideas as well, and maybe even skirting over into, you know, what I would refer to as being somewhat liberal, but I don't know all of that, and so that's why I'm here to ask you those questions.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think you can put him in a box. I mean, he does come from a very religious background. He grew up, you know, going to church on a regular basis. So his family was Catholic, and he continued to do that as an adult. And I would still call Bobby a very spiritual person. I mean, he's somebody who, you know, he prays, he believes in a higher power, and he at the same time he will take up, causes, I guess, you know, that they don't fit party lines. They're not a particular, they need to be done. And he's been willing to reach out over many years, as 40 years as an environmental lawyer, you know, to people who are staunch Republicans. And, you know, that's how he got the New York Watershed Agreement to happen back in the mid 1990s. I mean, he doesn't care so long as, you know, there's something that has to happen that he feels strongly about, whether it's public health or whether it's an environment. And he's, you know, he's so aware of what is called agency capture, you know, that these the EPA and the FDA, and they're in bed with the big industrial, you know, conglomerates, whether it's pharmaceutical or whether it's chemical or oil and gas, you know, I mean, this is what he's fighting against. You know, he feels like there's been this merger of corporate and state power that is destroying democracy in this country, and that's what he's looking to, you know, help resurrect the middle class and talking about these things in order to, you know, to do something about it. And I don't see any other candidate for president who's doing that, and it comes naturally to him because he's been at it for so long. And willing to take on the powers that be, no matter what, at personal cost to himself.
So, when we, I as you said, it's hard, I guess, to place him inside of any particular box. It, you know, there's an extreme level on each one of these things that if you go beyond. You know, I mean, I believe absolutely that we need to take care of the world in which we live in. I also believe that it's deteriorating and that Christ is going to come back and redeem it. And and some of the deterioration is not anything we can do anything about because, quite frankly, it's predicated on the fall of man and on sin, to the way that I understand Scripture to read. By the same token, we want to take care of it, but the hard end of that, like, for example, ending all petroleum and you know, ending gas cars and things of that nature, seemed to me to be counterintuitive.
Well, I mean, he knows we can't change things overnight, but he's He's called for an end to subsidies to the oil and gas industry. I mean, they're getting millions and millions of dollars from the federal government and have been for a long time. And he feels like more should be going into alternatives. But he's also a free market capitalist, you know, and he talks about how what we have right now is socialism really for the rich. And he thinks that's wrong. And I agree with him. So, you know, I don't think he's an extremist at all. I mean, I think he's a very practical guy who, you know, also feels like we should not be pouring billions of dollars into the war over there in the Ukraine, that money could, you know, that we need to help forge a peace, which he doesn't feel is impossible. And that you know, he saw his uncle do it and when he was president, or we wouldn't be sitting here talking today, because, you know, there would have been a nuclear war back in 1962. So,
right.
Again, he's had that kind of experience. And I think that his campaign is called Heal. The slogan really is Heal the Divide, because the country is so split between people who can't talk to each other anymore. And he's saying, let's have a conversation. We don't have to agree. Let's just sit down and talk as human beings. So that's where he's coming from.
Yeah, you know, and I don't disagree with pursuing the idea of the alternatives. I know and have watched and read, you know, George Soros, as an example, has said that the only reason that he got into the salt to the fans and stayed in it was because of government subsidies, because otherwise it was a losing proposition. They couldn't keep up with the demand.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're asking a question about that.
Yeah.
You know. I don't know about Mr. Soros, but I think that what we've seen is, as I said, this capture of the agency supposed to protect us.
Absolutely, the administrative state has got to go. I mean, and the Supreme Court looks like it may be going to take up the Chevron doctrine and get rid of it. And I hope that they do, because if they do that, then now the people are back in charge of those agencies, and those agencies don't get to run autonomously and run their own little kangaroo courts. They're working, the Biden administration is trying to give them the power to do an end around, even if the Chevron doctrine is pulled back. And hopefully, you know, hopefully Congress will step in and put a stop to that.
Well, we'll see what happens with all that. I mean, I don't have a lot of faith in the current administration or the previous one. I think we need a radical change in what's been happening with our government for some time now. And it's basically all bought and paid for, you know. I mean, the lobbying firms are the most powerful entities in Washington, D.C., and pouring millions of dollars into the coffers of people on both sides of the aisle. And I just think we need a big change. And to me, I mean, Bobby Kennedy has always been not a revolutionary, but he is certainly someone. He's a rebel, and he sees things in a clear way, and he studies science you know, assiduously, and has with the whole public health issue and with the environmental issues before that. So, you know, I think he's somebody who could bring the kind of change that we need.
Talk to me about what brought him. Well, I know there was, I mean, reports and things that I've read over the years. I'm 61, that I've read over the years about, you know, the addiction issues that seem to have befallen many of the Kennedy family. How did Robert break that cycle for himself?
Well, he went into a rehab program for 6 months initially and had a series of experiences. He's talked about, he even uses the word synchronicity, you know, that things happened that you couldn't explain, that what they were trying to move his spirit, his soul, in a direction that he needed to go in life that was positive. And he took that seriously. He studied psychology. He studied Carl Jung during that period. He became even more of a spiritual person, and perhaps not in as conventional a sense as growing up, but he's carried it to this day. So, you know, he had something to do that was very meaningful to him. He was a nature boy when he was a kid. He just loved the outdoors. He collected, you know, he had a whole menagerie of animals and wanted to be a veterinarian. So he had this feeling for the outdoors and was raised in rural Virginia on Hickory Hill. And then he suddenly had a chance to connect with people to protect the Hudson River initially, and then later waterways all over the world, forming the Waterkeeper Alliance, that, you know, 350 chapters globally that were fighting to protect our waterways. And so, you know, that's where he had that mission that he felt called to. I don't think he'd had that before in his life, but until he was in his late 20s, really. And he's never veered from that in one way or another.
What about the public service side of all of this? Because, you know, I mean, you know, irrespective of what you might have thought about, you know, that you mentioned not being pleased with the previous administration, I would say I was not pleased with some of the things that happened that President Trump, I think, was pushing against. And I think he was battling the same deep state that RFK Jr. has been talking about and wants to disband. And that is, as we've already seen, is quite a monumental task. Why does he think that he would be able to go in there and create a disruption? I know that was, I mean, President Trump went in there with the idea of creating disruption. I think he did some, but it was obvious that, you know, a lot of the good things that he did were quickly unwound, you know, within 100 days or so of the new administration coming in, which is the kind of stuff that we've seen. But what sets him apart that makes you believe that he can make that kind of a deep change?
Well, I think he's got a lot of experience, and he also knows the deep state in the sense of, you know, he's recently come out and spoken about the fact that, which I have studied myself, that there was basically a coup d'etat in 1963 that overthrew his uncle, who was trying to, you know, do things on a lot of fronts that the military industrial complex and certain other individuals allied with them were not in favor of, and he was killed by those forces. It wasn't just a lone nut named Lee Harvey Oswald, and that was true with his father's assassination too. So, you know, it's he's been there studying this about the deep state for a long time, and I don't know. I mean, is it an impossible task? It's not if you got the people behind you. And I think a lot of people are aware that we're living in a situation that is not for the people. And so he'll just give it his best shot if he could get in there. I think he also, the way he grew up and the values that he was instilled with by his family are real things. He wrote a book called American Values telling that whole story. And I highly recommend it. Tells a lot about him. So, and where he comes from, you know, he grew up around that dinner table, and they debated, they fought, they talked about, you know, all kinds of different viewpoints. And so it was an education that, he was lucky to blessed with having, really.
I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it's called disinformation. There was a General Pacheco. He was the highest ranking, defector from Russian intelligence in history. And a lot of the things that are on here, I was a Cold War Russian linguist in the United States Air Force. So a lot of the stuff that is talked about in this, we were briefed about through sources that we were privileged to have the opportunity to speak with. One of the things, though, that is on this is the discussion that it's likely that the CIA was involved in it, but that the hit on John Kennedy was in fact backed by Moscow. Yeah, and of course they, you know, did everything they could to try to deflect that, because they knew that if they were actually had that pinned on them, that certainly would have started a world war.
Well, that was the line that the Warren Commission was told. My research indicates something else, that it was made to look that way, that the Cubans and the Russians were behind it. That's why Lee Harvey Oswald was the patsy in this whole thing, because he had connections in both those instances. But my research indicates that it was that the disinformation was about that side of it, because Khrushchev and Kennedy had really reached an accommodation, you know, where they were looking based on the fact that the world almost ended because of this nuclear confrontation. And I think the two of them realized that hey, we've got to, and they exchanged letters back and forth that are now public about the difficult but vital need to reach some kind of peace and ban nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, which happened.
You might be interested in this. It check it out. It's called Disinformation. There's a book as well.
Okay, I've not seen that, so thank you.
Yeah, might be of interest to you. We're about out of time. Really quickly, if you wouldn't mind, we've talked about a number of different things relative to Robert at this point. What's the biggest thing that you want people to take away from the book that you've written about him, The Real RFK Jr.?
I think it has to do with moral courage, that he's somebody who's been through a lot of tough stuff in his life, real crises in all kinds of ways. And he's come out of that somebody who really gives a damn about people and has the guts to stand up and tell it like it is, the way he sees it. And he's not, may not always be right, but he's not beholden to anybody in the sense of wealthy people dominating his life. And so I think he's a fighter for the people, and that comes across in the various fights that he's been involved in to protect our environment over the years and ever since he was a kid. I hope people come away with that.
The loss of his father.
Yeah.
The addiction issues that he was challenged with. Yeah. Give me an idea, a couple of the challenges that he addressed that you feel build that character.
Well, I think in the environmental world, he had to take on issues that were not always popular, even among environmentalists. So okay. he would have to stand up and fight for the people of Ecuador who Latin America was very important to him from the time he was a kid and traveled there. He took up these causes that were not always popular. And certainly the public health one was extremely controversial.
Sure.
But he couldn't ignore the mothers who were coming to him and saying, hey, I think my child has been affected by mercury poisoning and the vaccines.
So, well, I sure appreciate that. My son was vax injured. I have two vax injured kids.
Oh wow!
So I'm very well aware of the damages that they can do, and I've had a lot of talks with Dr. Brian Hooker, who's a part of his team, as well as Dr. Judy Mikovits as well, who's done some tremendous research into that issue, and none are anti-vax. It's just how you're doing it, how you're preparing it, how you're putting it together. There's problems, and these problems were identified. And initially it was hoorah, hoorah for finding the problem. And then when pharma got a hold of it and their attorneys got a hold of it and the dollars got a hold of it, it was, oh, you better shut them up. And
that's right.
And people lost their lives for blowing the whistle on this stuff. So I appreciate that. Thank you, Dick, for being with me today. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation. I sure have.
I have too. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. My sincere pleasure. The Real RFK Jr. is the name of the book. Dick Russell, his good friend and confidant, has written this great book for you to get an idea. You know, look, we live in a constitutional republic, and we need to look at all of the candidates that have decided that they want the opportunity to turn our country around. And give them an opportunity to make their case. So thanks for coming on and making the case today.
Really appreciate you having me. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you. All right, we're going to take a break. Come back. Dr. Carol Hornsby-Haynes is with us. Reparation math. Reparation. They're figuring out how to teach reparation math. Yeah, we'll be back to talk about that coming up right after this brief break. I'm your host, Pastor Greg. We'll get more.
My passion is the fight for freedom. My father fought for him World War II defending our country. Today, we are no longer fighting with guns. Instead, we are fighting an ideological battle for control of our country by contributing to causes that support your constitutional rights. I am Patriot Mobile.
That was a shooting gallery up there.
I could hear the tremble in his voice.
She suffered a fairly severe beating, and the video is pretty graphic.
Justice for us seems almost impossible.
It's not fun to watch somebody die, and they knew she was in mortal peril.
They have not asked the hard questions. Why was the Capitol intentionally unsecure that day?
The FBI had information about security concerns before January 6th.
They're out for blood, and they're getting it. They appear to be winning.
Were the actions of the Capitol Police out of line? Were there violations in use of force?
Now I describe it as an inside job.
I'm ready to do whatever God calls me.
There's an old Chinese saying my ancestors learned before the Communist Party took over our country. The family is the essential unit of human society, and that you must have honor and defend your family. But it's not always easy to do.
When the regime gives the order, you have to kill.
My heart was pounding. I felt my body bouncing and twisting on the floor. They put numbers on our shoulders, then separated us into rows of even and odd numbers. I was number 9. My brother, he is still in prison. And my sister, she was sent to a labor camp without a trial. But there's one piece of evidence they haven't been able to destroy yet. I left everything behind. If I can't expose what they did to us, then all of our suffering would be for nothing.
Welcome to Chosen Generation with your host, Pastor Greg Young.
But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should shew forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy.
And now, Chosen Generation, where no topic is off limits and everything is filtered through biblical glasses. And now, here's your host, Pastor Greg.
And welcome back to Chosen Generation Radio, where no topic is off limits and everything filtered through biblical glasses. Thanks so much for being with me. I hope you enjoyed our last segment, The Real RFK Jr. with Dick Russell. That was really insightful, and I hope you enjoyed getting that insight. Well, I'm very, very pleased to welcome my next guest, Dr. Carol Hornsby-Haynes, is with us. And we're going to talk about a topic that a lot of folks may not be aware is being in, although it is part of the 1619 Project concept and critical race theory, which we've covered here on the program. I want to welcome Dr. Carroll. I hear a lot of noise in the background, Dr. Carroll. I'm sorry.
Oh, you need to move this. Hold on just a minute.
No worries.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you good. I can hear you good. There was just kind of a clumpity, clumpity, clump, clump, clump. But we're good. We're good. Is that your husband there? How do you do, sir?
Good morning. How are you? Let me get this adjusted for her so y'all can.
He's our tech guru.
I love it. I love it. Well, it's great to have you with me.
Are you getting feedback?
No, I'm good. We're good to go.
Okay.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, sir. Nice to meet you. Well, folks, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Carroll with us today to discuss a topic. Again, you know, when we talk about CRT, they've told us that doesn't exist. They're not teaching it. We know that's not true. We've had a number of guests on to discuss that. But now we have a component of that, Dr. Carroll, called reparation math. Talk to me a little bit about what is this reparation math, and I guess the question folks need to be thinking about is why it's of such great concern.
Well, as you indicated, it is part of the 1619 Project. We know that is all about revised history, claiming that America was founded on slavery. Well, now this reparations math and reparations history—they're actually putting both of them in. Is trying to teach the students that they are victims of slavery, and that because of this, this is a big gap between the black, and that they are low income, and that's another lie there. They're using something called, it's a big buzzword, culturally responsive teaching, and what they do is they fuse political lessons, and in this case, they're fusing math and history in through the Common Core math and social studies standards. So now we have Common Core and we have critical race theory, we have Marxism, we have the 1619 Project. And over about 3 to 4 weeks period, what they do is they go into the sugar industry and all other industries and say, well, these were founded, these were based on slavery. And because of this, this is a wealth gap for the African Americans in the United States. So they take the math skills and then they determine whether or not reparations should be paid to the descendants of enslaved people in the United States. Now, then they're going to, part of this course is the students will then figure out how all this billions are going, it's actually in the trillions, are going to be doled out by white taxpayers. So that they're pulling that together with math and with history. It's really quite clever the way they do it. And if they go back, the reason it's such a lie, Pastor, is that Thomas Sowell, the icon, if you remember that he was an economist, he wrote about the poverty gap there. And when you look at the poverty gap, most people think, even white and black, that the black income is that most live in poverty, and that's not true. Only 18.8% of blacks, and American blacks, live in poverty. Fewer than 1 out of 5. So when you talk about this, and then they want to go into, well, how many people were enslaved in the United States? Well, the way the left makes it sound is we were the biggest culprits on the face of the earth. We had more slaves here than everybody. Well, out of the 12.7 million of the Africans who were sold into slavery by their own people, and this was over 375 years from 1500 01 to 1875, only 2.4% came to the United States. Most of them went to Portugal and to England. Today, we have 3 times more people in slavery today in the whole world than we did in that whole 400-year span of time. And guess what? Almost half of the world's countries have slavery at some point. They don't criminalize it, but 94 countries out of nearly 200 have slaves.
Well, and not to mention the fact, if I could just throw this in, not to mention the fact that the majority of the slaves today in worldwide are found in Africa. I mean, that's where the majority of them are. I'm on the advisory board for Save the Persecuted Christians, and we are regularly getting, I mean, I get reports 2 to 3 times a day about new groups of Christians whose villages are raided, and Muslims are taking them in as slaves and making the young girls sex slaves. It's terrible.
You know, that's a very good point. I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I don't think most people know that, and I didn't know those numbers on there, so it's really something to start following. You know, what's so interesting is that today, American blacks are richer than 90% of the people in the whole world. They live longer than African and Caribbean blacks and even whites. And they have higher rates of literacy, and they've achieved more third degrees, post-secondary degrees. So most people think that American blacks are so, you know, poverty-stricken, but yet, as you point out, they are actually richer than those who live in Africa, the Caribbean, and much of Eastern Europe, and even Latin America. So, but do you think the whole point here, Pastor, is they're trying to divide America by making these children think that there's a wealth gap. That's the whole point of my going through this.
Yeah.
By this wealth gap, then they divide Americans. And the whole thing is to divide Americans, is to take down our morality. And once you've done that, once you've taken away the family, once you've taken away our faith, Americans cannot survive.
Well, and what you're doing is you're creating the divide, but at the root, and you mentioned this early on in what you were saying, the root of this is Marxism. This is a Marxist tactic. The Marxist tactic is to create hate towards a proposed group that supposedly has, to take from that group to give to the group that supposedly does not have. And that's the divide, and they use, you know, the fallacies, the economic fallacies oftentimes, in order to accomplish that.
You know, they're trying to make the children think that they're victims, because that's the whole thing today, is this victimization, which was a Marxist concept, the oppressors and the oppressed. Well, now it's the victims, and so these children are supposed to be thinking that they are the victims. And, you know, here's something else. We know that there are two-thirds of black children living in single-parent families. Where did that come from? That is from the government interfering.
Absolutely.
Government down to family.
Yep. Yep. Lyndon Johnson's great welfare society that was passed on the back end of the civil rights, which has destroyed. Because at the time that happened, the black American family was the more intact family in the entire country. Like 75% of black families consisted of a father, a mother, and children, whereas white families was somewhere between 68 and 72% at the time that the Civil Rights Act was passed and the Great Society was put in place.
And, you know, the poverty level had already started to drop. It was around 32% before the Great Society, the World Poverty. It had dropped to 14.7% before the War on Poverty. Once they started injecting all this federal money, then the rate started going up, because at this point now they were dividing the children. And I remember back all through the times of all the money that was being thrown into teaching, there was so much money being thrown into schools that literally the teachers could not use all the money, all the maps and everything. They were being stored and gathering dust in the schools. There were billions of dollars wasted money.
Oh, I remember that. I was on the school site council. No, this was in the early 2000s. This was well before some of the period that I know you're talking about. But I remember being on the school site council and we were talking about, you know, English as a second language courses and hiring, you know, instructors and after school programs and so on and so on. And some of the things that the principal shared with us was, is, look, we got to figure out a way to spend this money or they're going to cut our budget. If we don't figure out a way to use the money that they're giving us in the fiscal year that they've given it to us, then next year they won't. And these are the projected numbers predicated on who we think's going to be coming in and why we think we need this extra money.
It's called use it or lose it. And you know, the 1619 project is so pernicious because what they're doing is using slavery and this whole thing in the American society to denigrate capitalism. And how are they pushing the classroom is what most people think. And you know, you opened with a very astute comment that the school boards are saying, we don't have critical race theory. They've also said, we don't have Common Core in states like Texas, where I live now.
That's where I'm at, yep.
We have a ban on CRT. They just know how to do a workaround. And how do they do it? They say, well, we don't have that curriculum. We've never adopted that. True, maybe they haven't adopted it. But teachers go online and they pull down supplemental materials. And that's how this 1619 project has been pushing it out. They've already done this with English. Now they're doing it with math and history. What they do is they push this out to teachers under supplemental. Then the teachers go in there. They pull it down. They can rename it whatever. The school board can say, well, we aren't teaching that. Well, here's the question that parents and the public need to understand. Are you using reparations under any name for any purpose? What does it look like? Whether or not it's adopted, are you using any of it, any of the concepts in any way through supplemental materials or anything? And you know, when you say that, then they're stop dead cold because that's a lie if they say we're not using it.
Right.
They just adopted it. Or maybe it is not in their textbook, but it is there online. And this is how they've been getting critical race theory also in classrooms.
You know, it's interesting. I went through that battle. I don't know if you're familiar with Alice Linehan. Alice lives here in Texas. She's a friend. But she and I fought this and really brought a lot of this attention to this. I had her here in the Hill Country to speak several times about this. And we had this in our local school district, the Vandera ISD. And I was calling it out. I was on a local radio station when all of that was going on, but I called it out and they were getting phone calls and it got to the point where the superintendent of the schools called me and said, we need a meeting. And I went down and we had a meeting and I'll never forget. She came up to me in the parking lot of the grocery store here. It's a small town. And she said, hey, I just want you to know, we no longer have Common Core. We've cleaned it out. And I was like, well, hey, that's, you know, that's good news. That's good news. So we can make a difference.
Yeah, and with Common Core or CRT or any of this, and DEI, now that this is another thing.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
You know, they're pushing it down into the elementary. But even with this new Senate Bill 17 in Texas, they said, well, okay, we won't have this at the staffing level, but they aren't saying, they said it could be taught at the classroom level. So this is how they get around it. I've had people who head up charters here tell me, because they didn't know who they were talking to, say, yeah, we use Common Core, we just call it something different. So what parents have to do, they have
oh
to go
my
into
gosh, yeah.
Well, the textbook.
Well, and Dr. Curry, you mentioned something else earlier, too, about the moral aspects of this, because there's a huge, you know, moral foundation. And if you've got that moral foundation, you can fight a lot of this stuff off. But they're using this perverted sex concept and changing, you know, boys aren't boys, girls aren't girls. And forcing this just absolute deviance and destroying the innocence and just the natural proclivity of a child to repel at things that in their spirit they know are wrong, are immoral, but they beat them up with it and tell them, no, you're not right for not accepting what we're basically shoving down kids' throats.
And the whole purpose of that is to destabilize these children, and that way that they can be called out to go out and do all manner of activism, even to the point of murder. But they are teaching them, hey, when you don't have a moral foundation, when you don't know who your God is, when you are not of this Christian mindset, this destroys the morality, and with morality goes mental health. And here's something that I think perhaps our listeners would be interested in. This idea of bringing all this radical text into the classroom actually goes back to a Marxist beta test that they did back in the early 1930s in Hungary. And so what they were trying to do was to get rid of the family, and by getting rid of the family, then they were going to be getting rid of Christianity, they were going to be getting rid of this whole thing where they could start taking down into a totalitarianism. So what they did was they put into the schools there a radical sex program, and they started teaching them hatred. This was about free love. It was about sexual intercourse. And the students were being told to ridicule other people. They were being told to reject Christian moral ethics and monogamy and parental and church control, authority. Well, what happened? When they got through with these children, they became violent. They became murderers. They became robbers. They hated everybody. And they hated the clergy. They hated their parents. They disrespected everybody. They became bullies and became sex predators. And when you get into this, then you get into the homosexuality.
Right.
And that's what they're teaching these children. And so gradually, it just went downhill. Pardon me, it went downhill. That's the same program that they have brought in here. And they've had exactly the same result that they did back in Hungary. So it's one that they continue to repeat. And this is nothing new. Totalitarians understand it. Dictators understand it. They understand how to demoralize the people. That's the first thing they have to do. And this has already been done for America. We have a long way to go. We have a lot of work to do.
Well, and unfortunately, you know, on the conservative side, we're seeing conservatives just lay down for these immoral agendas. You know, they cheer on. They say, well, the gays that don't want to see, they say, well, children shouldn't be exploited, except that it's part of the overall agenda. And you can't stand on an immoral foundation and then yell at another immoral foundation. Immorality is immorality, period. Now, the good news is that we have Jesus Christ as the answer to set people free from that immorality. That's the good news. That's the good news of the gospel. But unfortunately, the church has muted itself when it comes to addressing these issues.
And, you know, we're Episcopalians. I grew up as a Southern Baptist. And all of this is so foreign to me. But I've seen not only the Episcopal Church, and not everybody, but you're talking about leaders. You get into the Presbyterian, the Baptist, Southern Baptist Convention. I don't need to tell you where they've been going.
All of them.
Accepting the critical race theory, they've been accepting this transgenderism. Now, they won't always call it that. They use the euphemism. They use the touch-feely word, and they've accepted it. And I get letters from them almost every day saying where they're going with the Southern Baptist Convention. What I'm getting is from the Ethics Committee, and I'm thinking the Ethics Committee, and they're telling me from the Ethics Committee this is okay. And so where do you go with this? But I know one thing. We turn away from God. God turns away from us. There is no way this nation is going to be salvaged or saved, Pastor, unless we turn back to God.
Well, and the American Episcopalian Church, many of them, because I was pastoring a church, and we were renting at a Nazarene church, and just up the road there was an Episcopalian church congregation. When the American Episcopalians embraced the homosexual agenda and said, we're going to go with that. And that congregation said, no, we don't want to go with that. We won't be a party to that. And they were kicked out of their building. They aligned themselves with the Anglicans, I think in Africa, if I'm not mistaken. And then they went and rented a building downtown and they flourished. But it was so sad to watch, you know, a longstanding denomination that had such a rich history embrace that, just as the Presbyterian USA did, and now the Southern Baptists are opening themselves up to this, the Methodists. Yeah, I mean, all these mainline denominations are all, but I think a lot of it is rooted back in, you know, what we're talking about relative to education, the education in the seminaries. They're teaching that this Holy Bible is just, you know, written by men and filled with suggestions. Not the Word of God, no absolute truth, just the word, just you know, a book of well-crafted fables written by men with a few good suggestions for how you might want to live, but they're a little over the top. I mean, goodness gracious, that's crazy.
You know, there were a number of years ago, Bob and I were attending Sunday school because we really liked the Sunday school message. And we were going over to a Methodist church in Highland Park here in Texas. And we got to know people who were in the on the staff at SMU there, which was that, you know, used to be the church school.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in all of that, we learned that there were eight Marxists, there may be more now, sitting on the staff there in the theology department at SMU. And this SMU, at one time when it was founded, if you went to school there, you had to attend church services every Sunday morning. You had to. Now it doesn't matter. And so where do you go? In fact, some of the people from the Methodist Church actually told us by the year 2050, all the mainline churches, denominations would be gone. And, you know, this comes back to this parallel society, Pastor, because people say, well, what do we do? What do we do? It's already been done. We already have a parallel society that's going on under the radar.
Yep.
We have all kinds of free market education. We have new banks that are coming up. We have new, very conservative, back to the classic colleges that are coming forth.
Yep.
I mean, people can even worship at home, but they have their own churches, new churches that are springing up. We have friends who are part of communities where they are growing gardens, and they're all sharing, and they're doing things, and they're sharing just like our early, in the 1800s. If you could do this, then you would barter your services for that. And people are doing, and they're having so much fun, and guess what? They're becoming so close. And back to what brings Americans together is that faith and that community spirit. And it's that parallel society that's under the radar. And, you know, one of the people there at SMU told me a long time ago, he actually was an Episcopalian. Would you believe that? It's easier to start a new church than to clean up an existing church that is so far gone. It's the same thing when you have schools or you have any institution. Our institutions may start off conservative, Pastor, but they always tend to trend left. So we have to watch that pattern.
Amen.
Amen. Then we take our money. What do we see parents doing right now? I'm not going to have my child treated this way by Target or anybody else.
Here we go.
I'm shopping elsewhere.
Amen. Amen. Dr. Carol, thanks so much. What's a good website for you?
www.drcarolhhaines.com. And that's Dr. drcarolehhaines.com. It's been a true pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so very much. I greatly appreciate it. I look forward to having you back. We'll talk about this more. This isn't going anywhere, and we got to keep it right out there in front of people. So thanks for being with me today. I appreciate it. We're going to take a break, folks. When I get back, Ken Thornburg is with me. We're going to talk about spiritual warfare next. We have got to fight this. It's evil, and we've got to fight it. I'm your host, Pastor Greg. You're listening to Chosen Generation Radio. Back with more right after this.